From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the thunderstorm that slammed Metro Detroit. How did it get so bad so quickly?
It was about double of what we expected.
Independent grocers working to erase Detroit's food desert image.
Once we showed people what the stores really looked like on the inside, it really changed a lot of hearts and minds.
Should UP communities stake their hopes on a resurgence of copper mining?
Those companies will come, they will take what they need to take, and then they will leave.
And how a former Wolverine football player turned a battle with depression into a way to help other student athletes.
You know, I'm tougher than this. I'm going to beat it, and I'll just grind it out. And of course, that made it way, way worse.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Food deserts. It's a persistent story in Detroit. The idea that residents in the city have few, if any, options for fresh foods and groceries. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, why that myth prevails and what Detroit grocers are doing to stop it. But first, a rainstorm for the history books. Deep, widespread flooding across southeast Michigan. Rising waters left sections of freeways and streets completely impassable. Firefighters and paramedics helping motorists to safety from partially submerged cars. Basements flooded across Metro Detroit after the city's largest single day of rainfall in decades. Mark Torregrossa is MLive.com's chief meteorologist and runs FarmerWeather.com. Now, Mark, we expected rain, didn't we?
We did, and we expected heavy rain. Up to 2 inches, but it looks like a large chunk of the Detroit area had at least 3 inches, and a big chunk of it had 4 to 5 inches with some isolated 5 to 6 inch amounts. So it was about double of what we expected.
And what happened then? What did Mother Nature, what kind of curveball did she throw us that we didn't expect?
Well, I always tell people it's really hard to forecast what I guess I would call a historic event. I mean, I think we're going to see the water recede very quickly here. But, you know, you can get up to the point where you can forecast a bizarre 2-inch rain across the whole area. But to forecast the historic event is pretty tough. And what happened basically is it just had a lot more moisture. And I'll be honest, a couple of the computer models that we have nowadays hinted at 3, 4, 5 inches of rain. But you just don't forecast that because it's a very rarity, I would say.
And you've said this all along as we've talked, that we have to start preparing for real curveballs and unusual weather events.
Yeah, we do. You know, you get these heavy events like this, and you just don't believe that it can happen because it's a 1 in 50 year or 1 in 100 year event. Now, I wouldn't call this a 100 year flood because I think it appears as though everything is going to go down fairly quickly, and where we would have gotten in a real mess is if we had another storm like this lined up, you know, right after this. But it looks like we're going to have some fairly dry weather right on into the weekend. So this is going to be a mess, a mud mess, a basement mess. It was a nightmare driving yesterday, but I think we're going to see the floodwaters recede fairly quickly.
MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist Mark Torregrossa. As always, thanks, Mark.
You're welcome.
And now to Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter, Sarah Swick. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Cindy. Good to be here.
Well, help us understand, Sarah, how did 5 to 6 inches of rain lead to 14 feet in some places of standing water?
I mean, it started where I live, which is in Royal Oak, just about a couple miles north of Detroit in the Woodward area. It started raining about 4 o'clock really hard. And at some point, I realized that I had never quite seen anything like it because it rained hard and continuously for more than 3 hours. And by the time it was all said and done, there were major problems, especially on all the freeways, but on the I-696 and I-75 interchange, which is pretty near where I live. In addition to obviously being pretty deeply recessed, as most of the freeways in Metro Detroit are, there is a pumping station that, like many of those water pumping stations on the side of the freeway, completely basically blew up and started spewing water all over. And people were genuinely trapped in their vehicles and had to get on top of their vehicles and rescued by firefighters. And it was really quite dramatic and I'm sure extremely scary for people who were there.
What are we hearing from officials, especially as to any idea when area freeways are going to be drivable?
Well, MDOT is saying that it could take up to a couple days for the waters to actually recede. I mean, there's obviously they're trying to help it along with pumping and whatnot, but just in terms of the sheer amount of, as you said, you know, I'm sure most people have seen the pictures at this point of, you know, overpasses marked at 14 and some feet, and the water is almost all the way up to the overpass. So it takes a while to get that much water out, and then there's going to have to clear the vehicles that are stuck down there. I understand there are state police divers who are, you know, have been scoping out the situation and trying to see what's down there. So it's going to take at least a couple days, if not, you know, it'll be later this week, I think, before all the freeways are open and completely passable.
How are residents responding?
I think as well as people can. I mean, since it was so completely unexpected, I think people were just sort of, you had to sit there with a sense of, you know, the water's coming in, it's coming closer, and it's in the house. And, you know, people are helping their neighbors to some extent bail water out of the basement. But, I mean, it's just going to be a slow, pretty gross, frankly, cleanup process for a lot of people, especially getting water out of their basements. And, you know, there's been a run on Home Depot, I've heard, in the neighborhood, and all the hardware stores. The pumps are in short supply, and fans, and just trying to get insurance claims. It's going to be a nightmare for a lot of people over the next few weeks.
Certainly something that will be remembered for a long, long time. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reporting from Metro Detroit. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
We head overseas. That's where a British mining company is at the center of a bitter dispute with Europe's oldest indigenous people. For more than a year, Beowulf Mining has been planning to drill for iron ore in the far north of Sweden against the wishes of protesters from the 20,000-strong Sami population who live there. Many say their traditional pasture lands will be threatened by this mine. Our partner with the BBC, Stuart Hughes, reports from northern Sweden.
There are 8 seasons in the Sami calendar. Each coincides with a stage in the life of their reindeer. In the mountains, in midsummer, Sami herders mark the newborn calves that are beginning to roam these lands. For a few short months, the sun never dips below the horizon.
You can see tracks of reindeers, even now.
Deep in the forest, Sami activist Henrik Blind points out fresh hoof prints in the mud. It's here, at the site of the proposed Kallak iron ore mine, that the British company Beowulf Mining has been carrying out test drilling. That's something Henrik Blind can't accept.
It's very sad, hard to find words. We are so connected to these lands. And to feel that nothing compared about the minerals that the Swedish government is saying that that's more important for the Sweden before our culture.
A traditional Sami chant, or yoik, sung during protests against the Kallak mine. Last summer, police moved in to remove demonstrators who'd blockaded the site. The Sami have lived across Scandinavia for thousands of years, but Jenny Wick Carlson from the Swedish Sami Association says their history remains largely unknown.
In the Swedish school system, you don't learn about the Sami. You know more about Native Americans and people around the world than your own indigenous culture. And it's quite sad. When you know it, you could also want to protect it more, of course.
I'm at Sunday evening service at the old red wooden church in Jokkmokk, the nearest town to the Kallak mine. About 3,000 people live here. Most of the worshippers at this church are in their 50s or 60s. And that's the biggest problem for the town as a whole. The population has been getting smaller and older for decades. Stefan Andersson is the mayor of Jokkmokk. He says mining could give local people a reason to stay here.
My feeling is, first of all, that a vast majority of the population is for mining. Of course, there are downsides with creating a mine in our municipality, but our belief is that it will mostly be on the good side. There are nurses, carpenters, welders, all different kinds of job opportunities.
Kallak, called Gallok in the Sami language, has become an iconic struggle for Sweden's indigenous community, a symbol of what they see as the colonization of their land by powerful outside interests. The lyrics of this protest song speak of short-sighted greed, of resistance against invasion by thieves. The executive chairman of Beowulf Mining, Clive Sinclair Poulton, believes such emotive language isn't accurate, and the two sides can coexist.
Sweden has to go ahead and decide what they want to do in the north. If they want to go ahead and keep it purely for reindeer herding, it's their right to go ahead and do so. However, we believe you can have a mixture of tourism, mining and reindeer herding. Don't forget, the vast majority of Sami who are involved in reindeer herding need other jobs as well. We would hope that we could go ahead and employ them in the mine to give jobs and allow them to continue doing reindeer herding.
Last year, the Swedish government published a new strategy to strengthen its position as a leading mining nation. It wants to treble the number of working mines within 15 years. Sweden believes mining can be carried out responsibly and sustainably for future generations. But some observers are more sceptical. Arne Muller is the author of Dirty Billions, a book about the Swedish mining industry. He points to a recent test case over a planned nickel mine in the northwest of the country.
Here, a court ruling had said that it is impossible to combine reindeer herding with the starting of a new mine. So the government had to choose, and it said that the mine comes first in this case because a new mine creates several hundred jobs. And the reindeer herding, that's a question of 10, 20, 30 jobs. If you make this comparison, the mine will always win.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Copper, its use and prevalence in our lives is astounding, as is the price we pay for mining the metal that we rely on. That's what my next guest discovered when he moved to Bisbee, Arizona, a town with a century of copper mining history. Bill Carter unwittingly found himself directly affected by the mining industry in his adopted hometown. That, in turn, led to his book, Boom Bust Boom, a story about copper, the metal that runs the world. Bill Carter, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Tell us, why is copper, as you call it, the metal that runs the world?
Yeah, you know, when I first started writing the book, like most people, you know, we hear more about gold or aluminum or iron ore, and they get more of the headlines. But truthfully, copper is the thing that all of us are using on a constant daily basis, whether it's plumbing in your house, so it's hidden behind your walls, or whether it's in your car, your computer, your watch, your anything that's electric has copper in it. And the amount of copper in our homes, 400 pounds of copper in our homes, on an airplane, 9,000 pounds, in a car, 50 pounds. It's kind of this invisible metal. It's not invisible, but it's something we don't look at. It really is what we would call running modern civilization. Copper really took off when electricity was found, and we've never looked back. I mean, people have tried to replace it with other things, primarily aluminum, but that was a disaster when homes were burning down because it's not a very good conductor of heat. So it's kind of, you know, built into the machinery of what we call modern civilization.
And as you point out in your book, Boom, Bust, Boom, there's absolutely no way we could back off from our consumption of copper and our use of copper and continue in any way, shape, or form the lives that we all take for granted.
Yeah, the only thing we can do is create a new technology, and they are working on that. There's some breakthroughs, maybe graphene. That's a new product that might be an answer. Right now it's not, but it could. There are people trying. Copper as a metal is an absolutely phenomenal thing. It's kind of this own little creature of how it behaves. It's kind of amazing. It has incredible properties of antibacterial. It has, you know, conducting heat, electricity. You can bend it, but then it gets hard if you don't touch it, so you can bend it like a plumber can. It's kind of an amazing metal. It's been used by humans for about 10,000 years. It's kind of irreplaceable at the moment, but that doesn't mean in the future it won't.
But when you decided to move to Bisbee, copper really wasn't on your mind, right? And how aware were you of the mining history in Bisbee?
No, you know, we're all very, in some ways, very simple creatures, aren't we? I moved to Bisbee because I liked the town. I liked the way aesthetically how it looked. I liked the people I met. It's very creative. It's turned into kind of a artist colony, a very eclectic town. And it's very unique architecture that was built by the mining community. But the mine itself, which is a huge open pit about a half mile from my house, I just kind of ignored it, like we tend to do. We were very good about that kind of stuff. We're good about ignoring these things that might be bad. And I just ignored it and thought it was a kind of an interesting history. And then I realized that southern Arizona has 10 super mines. It's one of the biggest copper belts on the planet. I was living right square, at the, you know, kind of the bottom right of it. I didn't really think about that. And most people I know in Arizona don't think about it. It's not something you think about, but it's an active, huge industry in this state.
And then you planted a garden in your backyard.
I did. I planted a garden. I had my first daughter. She's about two at the time. And my wife was pregnant with our second daughter. And I've always been a gardener, so I was really, really involved in redoing the drip system, stirring up the dirt, and just really kind of going for it. That went on for quite a while, and then everything started to grow, and then I started to eat it. My wife wouldn't eat it because I think it's a mother's instinct. She just didn't trust the dirt because it was an old copper mining town. I thought, oh, come on. I grew this. It's okay. I ended up becoming very ill, and I had high levels of arsenic and lead. And then the mining company, just coincidentally at that time, was starting to reclaim properties and test the soil. And if they were polluted, they would change the soil. So we applied. And they showed high levels of arsenic and lead.
That must have been just a stunning moment for you as a husband and as a dad.
It was overwhelming. It freaked us out. We felt suddenly trapped in this house that we loved and town that we loved, and very concerned about, you know, okay, they're testing that on my soil. That's what they found in my soil. So you have to assume it's on everybody's soil, and it's on every single thing around this entire town. And in fact, it is. They've replaced in the last 5 years almost every single house's topsoil, every park, every school's yards. Everything's been replaced. It's still going on now to about $70 million now of replacing all the soil because all of it is heavy arsenic and heavy lead. And that did not come from anything that happened during the open pit phase. What it came from primarily was from the smelter that used to be in Bisbee. That was something that if you live around a smelter, it's spewing out heavy metals. The point, though, is that freaked me out as a parent and as a resident and as a citizen, as a human being, was these metals that we don't see, they don't go away. You know, once we dig them up and they just disappear, we think, oh, you know, they're kind of gone. They're not gone. They don't go away for thousands of years or ever. They just kind of settle back in the dirt that you will eat or you will sniff or you will be part of. So, you know, that's something to keep in mind whenever a copper mine's coming to town, is that it is going to pollute your area, whether you like it or not, or whether they're very good at their job or not. It's going to happen. And it's a matter of degree of how bad it is.
I'm speaking with Bill Carter, whose book, Boom Bust Boom, A Story About Copper, the Metal That Runs the World, really came out of his firsthand exposure to the effects of the copper mine and the smelting operation in his adopted hometown of Bisbee, Arizona. How did that whole experience, Bill, launch you into this incredibly deep dive, exhaustive look into our relationship with copper?
It's kind of who I am. I tend to suddenly be part of whatever life I'm in, and then I realize something about it's amazing I didn't know about, and then I started to research it and write a book. I mean, I've written other books in that same way. As I started to research it, it was blowing my mind. Every aspect of copper was blowing my mind, which I love, and so that really took me deeper into this. And you know, it's one of those things that we don't think about. We do not think about something like copper, but everything from its history to the people who run the show to the families that have run it in the past in America and where it is now, and also how environmentally destructive it is to our communities, but how much we are trapped by the fact that we need it. All of it was totally fascinating to me.
Well, we have certainly seen in our state of Michigan how copper can be such a driver to the economy. Since the Upper Peninsula once produced nearly all of America's copper, and Michigan's history or its influence is really seen in Arizona's copper industry still, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of towns here are named after towns in Michigan. A lot of the companies that eventually started Arizona copper industry, almost all of them came from Michigan. What happened is, you know, Michigan was the home of the largest native copper found on Earth. They had a huge native copper, which is really what that means is like finding huge nuggets of copper, pure copper. But, you know, anything like that is going to be exhausted really fast. Same with gold, because it's just sitting there. Once that went away, the people who made all the money in Michigan needed a place to go, and Arizona started, and it had longer, deeper veins. Not as pure by any means as Michigan, but something you could sustain 100 years or more, longer. Now we're into our second century of copper. So a lot of those companies moved out to Arizona.
But just like we've seen in Michigan and you've discovered in Arizona, the toll that these copper mines takes, not only on the earth, but on the people who work in the mines and live around them, is, as you spell out in your book, it's mind-blowing.
This whole myth, there's a lot of, I guess the best word maybe is nostalgia. You know, people grew up in mining towns. There's plenty of examples of people in Michigan and Arizona. And they have a pretty good life, at least the way they advertise it, like from the 60s or 70s. But there's a couple things to remember. One, they had unions back then that were very powerful. In Arizona, the unions were broken in the mid-80s. Before that, the unions had enough power to kind of create a better life. Now, that doesn't happen. There are no unions. You're just a day worker being pushed as hard as you can. You have no guarantee of employment, per se. You know, if it's a company town, they give you a house for very cheap. But as soon as the market drops by a little bit, bam, you have to get out of the house. So the whole, I grew up in this town, and it's really wonderful, and it's a great thing. That might be true. It might be true, and I'm glad. But the truth is, the boom-bust-boom cycle, right? Michigan's a perfect example. You had a boom that was monstrous in the 1800s. You had a bust, and the Upper Peninsula has been busted for a very long time. And you're getting a little tiny taste of a reboom. But let's just be very clear. Those companies will come, they will take what they need to take, and then they will leave. And those towns, if you rely on that one industry to somehow build your town, you will go bust. And then you will have nothing. In Upper Minnesota, where I went, they're trying to put a mine near the Boundary Waters, which is kind of a precious resource of Minnesota and the nation. And there's a lot of jobs based on, let's call it eco-tourism. Canoeing, lodging, fishing, things like that. Almost thousands of jobs around that area doing that. So when a mining company says, we're going to give you 300 jobs, you have to ask yourself, okay, it's 300 jobs. That's nice. It's going to be kind of mid-range pay. But no one's going to come here anymore if there's a copper mine. If you have a massive copper mine, you don't have tourism. They don't go hand in hand unless it's like a mine tour. I'm a little worried about these places that are thinking that this is going to be the salvation, when sometimes when they leave, they pull the rug out and you are left with more debts, an environmental cleanup that they suddenly can't pay for. And that's what I worry about with these communities. If you know what you're up against and you know who you're in business with and you can hold them to the fire for long-term projects or long-term environmental bonds, okay, maybe it works. Maybe it works and maybe it's worth it. I don't know. It's up to the communities.
Well, in fact, here in Michigan, as you talk about this kind of little resurgence in the Midwest, we've got a Canadian company, Highland Copper Company, planning a new mine at White Pine. It's just a few miles from Lake Superior. And you can certainly find people in the area who welcome the economic boost because they've been in the dumps since the mines closed in 1995. And then you find those who say, hold off a minute, this is a big step backward. And this really does seem to be the same dialogue wherever mines are proposed. And there really isn't an answer, is there?
It's a really tricky philosophical question because I understand the need. It's very obvious. Hey, this is going to give us some money. I get it. Because, you know, mining companies usually put money to the schools or to the town or, you know, whatever. Plus, there's the jobs. But when I go to these towns, I'm like, okay, if that happens, okay, great. But you need to be proactive in creating a second track because they are going to leave. They are going to walk away and forget your name. You know what I mean? People are disillusioned by the nice guy that comes to town. The nice guy that comes to town from the copper company is hired by the copper company to be nice and go to your town and talk nice and go to town halls and create, you know, maps and graphs that all look fantastic. That's what he's paid for. You're not getting the CEO or the shareholders or the people that are just going to ruthlessly turn on it and say, I don't know, where is that again? We're done. Forget it. Let's move to Chile. You know, you need to understand the people you're dealing with. You have to really, really be clear as a community to hold them to the highest standards of partnerships, but also environmental thresholds of what they can and cannot do.
But Bill, in your book in Boom, Bust, Boom, you actually lay out a challenge really for all of us. You really do a great job of pointing out this central struggle that, hey, we want these products that the copper gives us. We want our cars and our cell phones and our electricity and our water piping and our computer. But it's tough for us to think about the fact that we are part of this equation and the consequences that copper mining leaves for the people and places.
It's the basic underlying conflict of my book, for me personally. In my book, I'm exploring also a large-scale proposed mine in Alaska called Pebble Mine. And I used to be a commercial fisherman up in Bristol Bay, so I have a vested interest in seeing that fishery, which is the world's largest salmon fishery, survive. I already know, obviously, if you build an open pit mine, you're going to kill the fishery. If you think you aren't, you're not in reality. And I made this decision to put myself kind of behind my own words. Bisbee, Arizona was created by a mine. Bisbee is located in an extremely strange two canyons, unlivable in some ways. So the only reason it was built was because of the mine. And I know that. If they were to hypothetically open that mine again, I would be hard-pressed to protest it. But I would put everything I have in my life to fight Pebble Mine because they have never built a mine there, and I know what it will do. So, you know, I kind of made this decision, like, I do want the products, but if they want to do it in Bisbee, I understand. It's a mining community that, you know, was a mine, now it's a mine again. I'm not going to fight that, but I'm going to fight against Pebble. So I kind of made that decision in my own. And I think people have to make those decisions around the country, but it's a really hard one. It's like iPhones. You know, we find out eventually that they have a, you know, a factory of 500,000 people in China when some of it's, you know, really bad conditions, but yet I still have an iPhone. This is the hypocritical aspect of being a human being right now in the world. Our products come from somewhere in Africa. We don't know what the heck's going on. You know, if you want to really dig into copper, you know, go to Africa. China is absolutely taking over Africa to get their copper, their oil, their food, their lumber. I mean, it is unreal. When you stare at that copper mine, it's just part of a global system that we are all part of. And this has to go with, do we want to recycle? Do we want to, you know, kind of live as less footprint of a creature? To get really unscientific about it, it's like, you know, that whole thing where we're the cockroaches. You know, we are just eating up the world. We are. We are just devouring this planet. I only hope that we can figure out a way to do it better. Otherwise, we're going to kind of eat ourselves up.
And taking it back to an extremely personal level, you and your wife wrestled and wrestled with whether or not to leave Bisbee, but you ultimately did.
That's right. We did wrestle because we absolutely love that town. We have so many dear friends there, and we go back and visit. It's a magical place. It's the best place I ever lived in the United States. But I don't want to raise my kids in a place that I can't really kind of trust, not the people, but the environment. If I knowingly know that this is going to be potentially hazardous, why would I stay unless I'm trapped? So I left. It wasn't that I preached anything on the way out. I just left. It was my decision. You know, I wasn't holding some sort of protest downtown. That was our decision, and we stuck with it. I mean, everywhere you move is going to have something. I know that. You know, if you go to L.A., you're going to choke on smog. You know, everywhere has got something, but sometimes you can choose something that has a little less, and that's what we did.
Great food for thought as we contemplate a resurgence of the copper mining industry in the Midwest, including in the Upper Peninsula again. The book is Boom, Bust, Boom, A Story About Copper, the Metal That Runs the World. Bill Carter, really enjoyed the book and really enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's pretty hard to imagine driving without the guidance of the tricolor traffic light, isn't it?
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
Well, it turns out that tricolor light that keeps us from crashing into each other at intersections was the brainchild of a Detroit police officer. Matt Anderson joins us. He's curator of transportation at the Henry Ford. So, Matt, tell us, how was this tricolor traffic light made in Michigan?
Well, the light is generally credited to, as you say, a police officer named William Potts in Detroit. And there had been experiments with traffic lights before, but they'd generally been just two lights, one telling you to go, one telling you to stop. And you know, you'd have to obviously change your intentions very quickly when you saw the light switch. It was Potts' inspiration to put in that third light, the sort of amber caution, letting you know that a signal change was imminent so you could prepare for it, slow down, and be much safer on the whole.
That is, of course, it seems eminently sensible to us. And, of course, at the time, too, it was not uncommon to have officers in intersections directing traffic through, was it?
That's true. They experimented with any number of means to kind of control traffic. They would have officers just out in the intersection doing hand signals. They tried officers controlling traffic with semaphores like they used on the railroad. And some cities even built whole towers right in the middle of the intersection where an officer would climb up to the top and then either change lights, semaphores, wave hands, whatever, to try and control traffic.
So where was the first four-way traffic signal tower ever in the world installed?
Well, the first four-way traffic signal tower anywhere in the world was right at the corner of Woodward and Michigan Avenue here in Detroit.
And I saw somewhere that through the U.S. we have more than 36,000 intersections with the traffic signals. I'm wondering, did Officer William Potts of Detroit get any widespread recognition for this invention?
I suspect he didn't get a whole lot of money for the invention, but he certainly remembered to those who follow traffic signals, and there are those devoted to them as sort of the founder or the inventor of the three-light system. So his gift is sort of immortality of a sort.
Matt Anderson, curator of transportation at the Henry Ford. Matt, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
As Detroit slid into poverty and eventual bankruptcy, one of the oft-repeated themes was that Detroiters didn't have a place to shop for fresh, wholesome food, and instead they had to turn to party stores with an emphasis on snack foods, beer, and soft drinks. But is that food desert a myth? Ade Orobo says, yes, it is. He's president and CEO of Associated Food and Petroleum Dealers and represents more than 4,000 stores in Michigan, Ohio, and nearby states. Ade, why do you say the Detroit food desert is a myth?
Part of it was, you know, I wanted to educate myself when I moved here from Southern California 5 years ago. I used to hear this all the time. So the first thing we did was we actually put all the data together and we mapped it. And then once we showed people what the stores really looked like on the inside, it really changed a lot of hearts and minds, and that's why the Detroit News decided to run an entire article on this myth, this ongoing myth that a lot of people for different interests have been pushing out there.
What did the map tell you as you explored Detroit? What did that map show you?
The map really showed us the areas of Detroit that are still populated, still, you know, have life to them. So there's 75 full-line grocery stores in the city of Detroit, but it also told us how big the overall city is from a square mile standpoint. And we actually also had focus groups where we talked to different customers from some of the stores, and that one of their biggest concerns was more of public transportation or lack of good public transportation. It was very in vogue to, you know, kick Detroit for a number of years now, and we just wanted to get the truth out there. And so we said, here's the map. You decide if it's a food desert or not, because Ms. Gallagher, who came up with this term a number of years ago, everywhere she ends up going, it turns out to be a food desert. I mean, I think that word doesn't really have any credibility, especially if you talk to USDA, even different departments that deal with food access.
Food access sounds like it has more truth to it and more of a grasp of the situation. You referred to transportation as one of the food access issues. What else do you see as a food access challenge in Detroit?
Well, public transportation is probably the number one issue just because the city is so big. So you have stores where you have rooftops. When you have areas where you only have one or two people living on a street, you're not going to have a store there. So when you compare Detroit with a population of, you know, under 700,000 to other big cities, we have more food access. Another big issue actually is crime, because in an area where you don't have good public transportation and not everybody drives a vehicle, people walk. Well, people can't go to a grocery store, make big purchases, and walk home safely. So those are the two biggest comments we've received a lot from Detroiters, and that's why a lot of them carpool. A lot of them actually, when they want to make big purchases, actually go across the border to one of the subs. Those are the two major issues that we see as the problem.
And are there things that you feel that your members with the AFPD can do to help address these challenges?
You know, our association's been around since 1910, so it's 104 years old. We started in Detroit. So the grocery stores in Detroit have always been viable. They've always been there. The independents now have taken more of a hold because a lot of the chains have left, but those stores are not empty for the most part. Independents went in there and reopened those stores on different labels. It's interesting that a lot of the folks that actually have supermarkets in the city also have supermarkets in the subs. So they're the same operation. It's this myth that keeps on going on, that people always feel that, you know, Detroit is different. It doesn't get the publicity. And I really have the media to blame for it, as well as a lot of the folks that perpetuated this falsehood.
What do you think was behind perpetuating this?
I think people were really upset at Farmer Jack. Part of that was union pressure. Part of that was saying, you know, independent stores as well do not market the way that the big chains do. They have just as good product, if not better, but they just haven't been the greatest of marketers just because they don't have a number of locations with the same label. But independent stores do things that chains can never do. For instance, they know the neighborhood better. They're quicker on the move if somebody needs something. They actually give credit when somebody needs it just because they know Mr. Robinson or Miss Jones. They take care of them that way. And a lot of those things that where they are part of the fabric of the community really goes without any limelight. They just do it because they care and they actually spend more time in the neighborhoods they serve more so than even their families.
Ade, we're seeing an uptick in the presence of big chain stores in Detroit. Of course, the Whole Foods and the Medical Center, and then Meijer opened last year right at 8 and Woodward near the old state fairgrounds. And we know a second Meijer is going to open next year on the site of what used to be Redford High School. Is this causing everyone to kind of up their game and rise to the competitive challenge?
I think some people have, but I wouldn't say everybody. From visiting other stores across the state of Michigan, even Ohio, we do have some of the more competitive, from a price standpoint, stores in the city of Detroit. And I'd actually say if some of these stores were in other parts of the state, people would be, you know, oohing and aahing and wowing in terms of what they do and what they sell and everything else. So Meijer has come in, and we represent Meijer as well. they're welcome to come into Detroit, and it's a great thing. But the stores have not really been affected by the Meijer presence. If it's working for Meijer and it's working for Whole Foods, that's great, because that actually brings the attention of the city. It kind of takes it up a notch from a media standpoint, because people are now talking about Meijer and Whole Foods. But, oh, check out this store and check out this guy. And it gives us more attention to really tell our story.
And it sounds like you truly believe that independents can certainly compete in terms of price, of freshness, and of quality.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that, especially when you talk about the perishable sections, produce sections, meat sections. Those areas are commodities, so it's not like you could store truckloads or, you know, factories worth of produce without it going bad. So it's a commodity-driven market, while, you know, the interior of the store, the middle of the store, which like to say things like canned goods, processed goods, they have a 3, 4, 5, 6-year shelf life. The big chains could stock that up all they want and get a better pricing than the independents, because we just don't have the room in our warehouses.
Ade, as head of the AFPD, what are your personal goals and hopes for grocery stores in Detroit, let's say over the next 10 years?
Well, we just want to continue to see the grocery stores stay viable, and because they are really part of the community. When you shop a neighborhood a retailer, whether it's a grocery store or a gas station or even a party store, you're actually helping out your neighbor. That money stays in the area. When you shop a lot of these chains, you're sending the money to Arkansas, or you're sending it to Cincinnati, or somewhere outside. That's why we're even pushing farm-to-store aspects and buying local, the whole Pure Michigan label. We're really trying to push that, and independents really always been known for that, because they are your neighbor that you know, and they care more.
Ade Arabo, who heads the Associated Food and Petroleum Dealers, the AFPD. Ade, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having us.
When you think of student athletes, the phrase game face comes to mind. You face your opponents on the football field or the basketball court or the track or the lanes of a swimming pool, and you don't blink. You are there to win. Now, imagine being a part of that suck-it-up culture as you struggle with depression. The University of Michigan recently won a grant from the NCAA. They're going to launch a pilot program to increase awareness of mental health issues among student athletes. Daniel Eisenberg is here. He's an associate professor at the School of Public Health and a faculty member at the University of Michigan Depression Center. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we're joined by Will Heininger. He was a lineman for the Wolverines, and as he played for Michigan, he was battling severe depression. Today, he's working with this pilot program that links the U of M Depression Center, the School of Public Health, and the athletic department. Good to have you with us, Will.
Thanks for having me on.
So start with telling us, at what point in your playing career with Michigan did you start to feel clouds come in and feel that things weren't going right?
Yeah, so I think it's an important thing to note that it was a pretty short span overall. It was about 4 months during what was my, you know, the end of my freshman year, I guess, right when I moved home. So about May of 2008 through August 2008 was when I was really struggling. And that would have been, you know, end of freshman going into redshirt freshman year.
And what was that like? What was a day like? And give us a sense of what you were going through.
I mean, it was incredibly difficult, of course, but I didn't know what depression was. I didn't really know what mental illness was, because it wasn't talked about growing up. It wasn't something that was discussed. So at first it was just, you know, these racing thoughts and really dark thoughts and a complete change from my outlook that I had had my whole life, which was happy and, you know, well-rounded and successful and, you know, social. And all of a sudden I just was having these really down, depressive thoughts that I couldn't figure out, but I also didn't know what was going on. So you internalize and you blame yourself and you try to figure out, you know, why am I having these? What's wrong with me? You know, why won't they stop? And then, of course, trying to succeed in all the ways I was trying to succeed at the time. It was a pretty stressful situation.
And here you were. I'm sure that it was a thrill to make it onto the University of Michigan football team. So you've got all this going for you. And I bet you really had to wrestle with guilt at the same time you were trying to wrestle with these hopeless feelings.
Yeah, no doubt. Because, again, you know, you have your narrative of, you know, I grew up in Ann Arbor and this is a dream come true. And, you know, why do I feel like this? Where is this coming from? What is this? What's going on? You know, am I the only person in the world who feels like this? And of course, once I opened up and got help, I learned that, of course, I'm not. There's a ton of people and, you know, it really is a human condition, a human illness, and similar to other illnesses. It's just that we didn't talk about it. But at first, I really tried to do the athlete thing, and you know, I'm tougher than this. I'm gonna beat it, and I'll, you know, just grind it out. And of course, that made it way, way worse.
What cracked it open for you?
When I finally broke down, I had told my mom, but I really hadn't told, you know, many people at all. And I was, you know, still for months going to football and going to summer class and going to work and putting on my face, so to speak. And you know, one day after a practice in August, I just couldn't hold it in anymore. And I felt the tears coming and just being overwhelmed with emotion. And I was so sick of trying to hide it, I almost didn't care, you know, anymore. And luckily, one of our athletic trainers who are there with us every day, they know us, you know, inside out. He saw me and just put his arm around me and walked me inside to our athletic counselor. Her name is Barb Hansen, and just said, you know, you're going to be just fine. We'll help you get better. But it was getting all of my care sort of under one roof and just getting medical attention for it, like you would for any sickness, any illness, any injury, that helped me get better.
And Daniel Eisenberg, it strikes me that was the right person at the right time with the right response, but it could easily have been back to that old suck it up or you'll be okay response.
Right. Our research team has been collecting a lot of data on college student mental health in general. So we already know among college students in general, the majority of students experiencing major depression or significant anxiety disorders are not receiving mental health services. And then we've actually looked a little bit at some new data on student athletes from our newer survey, the Healthy Bodies Study, it's called. And so far, it looks like the rate of help seeking is even lower for student athletes. Whereas for general college students, it's maybe 1 out of 3 depressed students who might seek help. It's more like 1 out of 10 among the athletes in our sample.
And I'm wondering, and I'll whichever of you wants to tackle this question, is it a matter of athletes really believing that they can't tell anyone about their feelings because the position on the team would indeed be endangered, or do they think they do? I guess what's the environment on a typical team amongst the coaches and trainers?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's a complex question because yeah. Of course, when you're depressed, you're not thinking logically anyway. So, you know, any thought from, you know, I'm going to get kicked off the team to I'll never play to I'll lose my scholarship to they'll think I'm weak. You know, all these things are part of the thoughts that you have, but you can't decipher from reality and tell which ones are true and which ones are irrational. But there's also the stigma, which is part of, you know, my work that I do. When I do public speaking and, you know, on this project that we're trying to do is just, you know, there's no reason to be ashamed of any of this stuff. It's really normal. And, you know, I tell guys, you know, you tear your ACL, you know exactly what to do. You go to the trainer and you're going to have to get surgery and you got a lot of rehab and you get better. And it's no different, you know, with any of this. But the culture on, you know, on these teams is while you're close with each other, you know, you're so competitive and you're all trying to be perfect. And when you're on the field, at least in football, you know, you have to be very tough and there's a way that you play. And I had to learn to separate that from taking care of myself in my life, which was just a lesson I needed to learn at, you know, age 19 anyway.
But I'm betting that this goes earlier than college, right? Does it go high school, middle school? Is that just kind of that suck it up approach and I'm tough start at the beginning of your football career?
Yeah, it was something I learned very young.
Yeah. It is something parents, I think, need to be aware of, too, as they watch their young athletes. What are you hoping to do with this program, Daniel?
Our timeline, basically, is we're developing two components of the program. One is support groups for student athletes, which we're building on existing efforts for the general student population at U of M through what's called the Campus MindWorks program run by the Depression Center. And so we're going to be tailoring those groups for student athletes specifically. And second, we're developing a few very brief YouTube-length videos that we're trying to make as engaging as possible. One of them will feature Will's story. Another will feature the story of Callie Fahey, a swimmer-diver at U of M. And so those together, but the goal of both really is it's educational as well as kind of to provide some support, some basic coping skills, the message that seeking help is okay and this is a supportive community for students experiencing mental health problems. And so in the coming months, we hope to basically establish a model or at least a beginning that perhaps other colleges and universities will pick up on and we can kind of expand nationally with our efforts.
Yeah, and from the athletic side, you know, we believe in developing our athletes in general just as people and believe that, you know, the more well-rounded you are and really the more your off-field life is stress-free or at least taken care of, that you're going to perform better on the field, but you're also just learning to, you know, develop yourself as a person. These are formative years, you know, 18 to 22, 23. So we want to change that culture of in society, not just in athletics, that, you know, mental illness is something to be ashamed of. You know, not at all. It's a very common thing, just like, you know, some other, you know, diabetes or you name it. So from an athletic perspective, we want, you know, well-rounded, what we call world-ready student athletes when they leave.
Well, what is it like for you to talk to other students, student athletes? I know you can say to them, I was there. You know, I've been in a locker room and I know what this is like. What's the moment like for you if you can maybe see the light go on in someone's eyes?
It means everything because if you save one life, that's you've done amazing work and it's worth it. But, you know, I was speaking out at Virginia Tech last year and the student athletes, you know, it was, I think, 8 o'clock at night on a Wednesday and it wasn't a mandatory thing. So I didn't know how many people would be there. The baseball coach brought me in, so his players had to be there. But it turned out to be the entire room full of student athletes and they were just attentive and really interested and wanted, you know, we had a long Q&A session and some of it was, how do I help my friend? You know, some of it was, how do I know, you know, whether this is serious or not? And the overall message that I get from student athletes that I do speak with is just sort of, where has this been? You know, we want to talk about this stuff. We want it. It's just life. We want to be able to talk about life with our coaches and be open and not, you know, not be, you know, sort of robotic athletes, but to be well-rounded and healthy and perform better on the field and then perform better off the field. So it's really rewarding to talk about and to see the engagement.
A lot of work to be done, and it'll be interesting, and we'll look forward to kind of seeing what you're learning as this pilot program gets up and running. We've been talking with Daniel Eisenberg and with Will Heiniger, both part of this new pilot program at the University of Michigan, all aimed at increasing awareness and understanding of mental health issues for student athletes. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer today was Bob Scon. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.